Right now, we're going to hear an interview from the KABU archives with activist Phil Berrigan, who died Friday of cancer at the age of 79. In the late 60s, Berrigan was a priest in Baltimore, where he founded the anti-war group Peace Mission. In 1967, he and others from the group spattered liquid containing their own blood on local selective service records. Then in 1968, he organized a group that became known as the Catonsville Nine. After they took draft files from the Catonsville, Maryland draft board office and burned them with homemade napalm, Berrigan was sentenced to prison terms for both actions. While in prison, he secretly declared himself married to a nun, Elizabeth McAllister. After he was paroled in 1972, they legalized their marriage and both were excommunicated. They lived and worked in Jonah House, a religious commune in Baltimore. Philip Berrigan continued his anti-war and anti-nuclear actions throughout his life, spending 11 years in prison. He authored 6 books. He wrote a final statement in the days before his death. It included the line, "I die with the conviction held since 1968 and Catonsville that nuclear weapons are the scourge of the earth. To mine for them, manufacture them, deploy them, use them is a curse against God, the human family, and the earth itself." Today we'll hear an interview with Philip Berrigan, recorded in 1996. He was interviewed by Matthew Rothschild from the radio program Second Opinion.
Philip Berrigan, welcome to Second Opinion.
Thank you, Matt.
I'm surprised to see you here. I just found out that you were in Madison a couple hours ago. I thought you were still behind bars. When did you get out?
Well, I did a stretch in North Carolina because we did a plowshares action against the fighter bomber at Seymour Johnson Air Force Base.
What did you do exactly?
Well, we went with the prophecy of Isaiah and we beat swords into plowshares and we sent a plane to the shop. We did quite considerable damage. It was symbolic, and yet it was very, very real. And
so you took hammers to an airplane?
Yeah, and blood. Blood was poured into the air intakes, the engine intakes, and then we worked over the radar and some of the other very sophisticated equipment on the outside of the airplane.
Now, what kind of an aircraft was this?
It was a F-15E, they called it a Strike Eagle, and it was the workhorse fighter bomber of the Iraqi War. Killed tens of thousands.
And you were caught doing this?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Military maneuvers were going on at the base at the present time, so we had about 30 seconds.
How many people were with you?
Three others. And four of us all together.
Did you notify the authorities that you were going to do this, or you just went in and did it?
Oh, no. We don't. We practiced security for the action, let's put it that way. No, we don't notify anybody.
So you just go in and do it?
Yeah. The action, actually, is a statement to the officialdom there.
And when did this action take place?
December 7th, 1994. So I was in jail for most of the next year, and I've been on house arrest and supervised probation pretty much ever since.
And so what were you arrested for? What were you convicted of?
Destruction of government property. That was the main charge.
And was the trial before a jury or just a judge?
Let me see now. I've been through so many.
How many have you been through, by the way? How many times have you been arrested?
I don't know. Well over 100, I guess.
And you've been jailed or imprisoned how many times?
In quite some number. I've done over 7 years in prison.
Wow. So, and when was the first time?
In 1967, when we poured blood on draft files in the Baltimore Customs House, 1967. And so it's been almost 30 years now.
Well, that's going to be an occupation.
It's just a necessity. It's an imperative.
Why do you think going to prison is an imperative, or breaking the law is an imperative?
Well, because the only way you can get at the state is by dealing with its law. I mean, they're the same thing. And that's why Thoreau would say dissent without resistance is consent. A very, very weighty statement, but if you take it apart, you'll find that if you dissent without breaking the law, then you are legitimizing, you know, the system that allows this kind of latitude, if that's clear at all.
No.
So you have to break the law, actually, to touch the state.
Now, do you break the law to be effective or just or to bear moral witness? That is, if you knew beforehand that breaking the law would have no appreciable effect on what the government does, would it still be an imperative to break the law?
Yeah, it would still be an imperative. But I guess we do it for both reasons. You try to be a Christian. You try to come from that tradition of the Jewish prophets and then Christ and everything since, and that becomes your handbook, and you respect that, and you try to live it. None of us are perfect. None of us live it too well, but you go with that, and a witness is a very, very key word in all of that. You witness against the injustice, against the atrocity, against the heavy-handedness, and all of the rest.
I remember having Bonnie Erfurth, a peace activist here in Madison, with Nuke Watch on the show about a year ago. She spent many months in prison and in jail, too. And she is one of those people, very inspiring people, who just says, I don't think this is going to change policy. I just can't abide by it myself any longer, and I have to say no, mm-hmm. I'm not going to participate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We try to make a statement to other people, and we try to say through the symbol that's employed, actually, it's a construction symbol, that it's your responsibility, too. You have a responsibility to be constructive, and you have to confront the war game, the American killing machine, in order to do that. It's not just what we're doing that's important. It's what you should do. Try to say that.
And do you then try to tell everyone that they should engage in civil disobedience? Or you?
Oh, by all means. Oh, you bet. You bet. As Francis Boyle would say, he's the international law expert at the University of Illinois, he'd say it's both a right and a duty. It's both a right and a duty, and I think that's right.
Now, you talked about the war games or the war machine. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean what the Pentagon administers around the world, you know. We have military missions in maybe 70 or 80 countries. We have major military bases all over the world. And that's purely to protect our portfolio abroad.
No, portfolio is an interesting word. You mean our investments?
Our investments. And also our production. And also our exploitation of cheap labor and raw materials. We're on the scene to do that. And the military is there to see that happens.
Is there any difference in administrations, one administration to the next, as far as the war game or the war machinery goes?
No substantial difference. None whatsoever. From Truman on through, of course, John Kennedy and right up to William Clinton, no substantial difference at all. The war machine runs, the politicians, the whole political spectrum in Washington, D.C. The Pentagon is... Admittedly, it is the most powerful institution in history.
So, by your way of looking at it, the politicians then are the mechanics for the war machine.
They are, yeah. And behind that, the war machine enforces the status quo for the super rich and the rich. The politicians, of course, represent them above all. They don't represent the American people generally.
And how do we get at that war machine and that whole system of international repression and domestic repression?
We ought to start by waking up and getting out of Never Never Land and Disneyland, call it what you will.
And what has anesthetized us?
I guess the culture here in this country, Matt. Yeah. The culture is trivial and it's ugly and it's mesmerizing and it's devious and deflective and it's all of those things. And we were just up on the campus talking with some of the students, and The students don't realize what's happening to them, you know. This University of Wisconsin is a vast mill which is channeling them into jobs that are mediocre and is going to make them mediocre people. And that's what's happened. And the students are all cooperating with us.
Well, they want a job. They feel they need a job. They're worried about not getting a job. What do you tell them?
No, it's mostly what they want to hear, you know. You can tell them optional courses. You can say, you don't have to do this. You can do this. You know, you can live on a shoestring. You can serve the poor in Washington, D.C. You can appear at the Pentagon, you know. You can live poorly and live very, very well. You don't have to do this.
And are they receptive to that?
A tiny minority would be, yeah. I have one with, Jeremy is a dropout from the University of Wisconsin. He was a junior there.
And he brought you over to the studio today.
First of all, joined CCNV. That's Mitch Schneider's.
That's the Community for Nonviolence in Washington.
Community of Creative Nonviolence, yeah. And they staff and administer a 1,400 person homeless person shelter. Right near the Capitol building. He came there and stayed with them about 3 months, and then he joined us in Baltimore.
Now, tell me a little bit about the community you have in Baltimore. It's called the Jonah House, correct?
Yes.
And is it literally one house and a lot of people living there, or what is the community like?
Well, we have seven adults there. And we work with our hands. We do contract painting and roof work and masonry, carpentry, what have you. General home rehabilitative stuff. We do a little speaking every now and then. While I'm here, my wife is down at William and Lee in Virginia at a conference on William Stringfellow. We have a common purse. You know, nobody has any personal money, and we're accountable for what we spend. We live pretty much off the cast-off food of the society. We go to a huge produce terminal in Jessup, Maryland, and we pick over the garbage. And we only use about 5% of that food for ourselves. The rest is shared in the neighborhood with the poor. We live in a very...
Can you eat okay that way? It doesn't sound very appealing.
Eat beautifully. Really? Eat beautifully, yeah. And then we go to a food bank, and we distribute that food to the poor also. And then we do a lot of protests, not only at the Applied Physics Lab out of Johns Hopkins University, but also in Washington. We're in a sort of a privileged relationship with Washington because you can get down there in an hour.
When was the community formed?
1973.
And were you there from the outset?
Yes. Liz and myself both were, my wife.
And what was the object of forming? Was this to try to create a sort of utopia or an alternative way of living?
Well, some of the original ideas for this came out of prison. And it's something that we thrashed out after reading people like Gandhi and King and Thoreau and Emerson and others. We found that we could not stay in resistance unless we had a community. You need the mutual support. You need the exchange of ideas. You need people to talk sense to you. You know, good people. You need all of these things. You need a community. And we found out that Gandhi was experimenting with the ashram very widely before he was assassinated in the late 40s. So we went with that and found out more about it as we learned and made mistakes.
A lot of the experiments in communal living that started in the late 1960s and early 1970s seem to have fallen apart. This one has endured. Why do you think you've been successful where others haven't been?
I guess because we have a scripture, and I don't want to thump the drum about that at all, except that you have to measure your life against something, and that's a constant renewal to us. We help one another with that. And, you know, we studied the Old Testament, the Hebrew Testament, and then the Christian one. And we say, what's it mean to us right now, right now? That keeps us going.
For those of you who've just tuned in, program Second Opinion, I'm Matthew Rothschild. I'm delighted to be speaking with longtime peace activist Philip Berrigan. You talked about scripture and Christian inspiration. What do you make of the rise of the Christian right?
How could I make anything out of it?
Do you think it's...
The misuse of scripture is flagrant. It's flagrant. It's pretty shocking, you know. It's like saying, here's a text, and let's get into personal interpretation of this, and let's do as we damn well please, you know. The Freeman out in Montana might very well be another version of this. Certainly, David Koresh's people down in Waco, Texas, were.
I remember reading an article by a friend of yours, I imagine, Coleman McCarthy, who's also a friend of the progressives, who said if Jesus Christ were to return today, the Christian coalition wouldn't accept him.
Definitely. I think another aberration of this kind of Christian monstrosity was existed under Hitler, you know. That kind of misinterpretation of the scripture and private interpretation of it and all of that leads people directly into fascism. That's kind of a general thing, as far as I can tell.
Do you think there's a risk in this country of going into a fascistic direction?
Oh, I think we're already deep into it.
You do?
Yeah, with a contract on America, and with a Republican majority in the Congress, yeah. I think we're already deep into it.
Certainly, when I would listen to Pat Buchanan, I would hear echoes of what would be certainly a neo-fascist kind of mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see those things sometimes in Pat Robertson and other people who want to impose their theological views.
Well, Matt, the first seeds of that, of course, goes back to our conduct during World War II, you know, where we began to out Hitler.
Well, talk about that. I'm very interested in that. Were you opposed at the time to World War II?
Oh, not at all. I fought in Northern Europe. I'm a GI from World War II, and I was an infantry lieutenant during the war. And I had two brothers over there involved in the invasions of Africa, Sicily, Italy, and Normandy. My two brothers. So I was very much gung ho, and I was a good young killer, and only woke up later on.
So, in retrospect, do you think it was wrong of you to participate in that war?
Pardon me?
Was it wrong? Was that an immoral war? Were you wrong to participate in it?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Wrong to participate in any war, sure.
All wars?
Yes, all wars. And that was total war. I mean, we lost 70 million dead in the world through that war. And if that's necessary to bring a monster like Hitler down, we're through. What more can be said about us?
Well, what do you respond to the question, if we didn't fight Hitler, then Hitler would be ruling the world right now and exterminating everyone?
Well, that's an assumption. That's an assumption. There are all sorts of people that resisted Hitler nonviolently. You know, the Norwegians did, the Danes did, the French did. Not all fought with the French Maquis. On and on and on. You know, people all over Europe resisted Hitler nonviolently. And did it without noticeable loss of life. It's like the third force in Vietnam, huh? The third force. It was kind of a coalition of mainly Catholics and maybe even more so Buddhists who were taking nonviolent approaches to the war. And the provisional revolutionary government in the South, of course, was not only exerting heavy casualties on the Americans and the South Vietnamese army, but they were suffering them themselves. And the Third Force were bringing down regime after regime out of Saigon. They're bringing them down through their program, and it was overwhelmingly nonviolent.
Now, was the protest against the Vietnam War pivotal for you in changing the way you acted in the world?
Something happened before that. I was teaching in New Orleans African-American kids at a high school there when the Cuban Missile Crisis started in 1962 in October. And that was pivotal to me. Here was Kennedy and Khrushchev debating as to whether I was to live or die. We would have died in New Orleans and Jacksonville and Savannah and all those deep south ports if those missiles were ever fired, and then if we went into retaliatory measures. That was pivotal for me.
So did you organize protests at that time? Is that where your disobedience began?
I realized I didn't know anything, Matt. I had a master's degree and I was 37 years old and I didn't know anything. I was an infant.
So where'd you go from there?
Well, a lot of friends helped me and I started to read and started to talk and I started to seek out people who knew something. Fellowship of Reconciliation and then all of the civil rights groups. I was a member of all of them, the whole range, even the Urban League. And they helped me, They helped me, and I began to learn and grow up a little bit.
And then by the late 60s, you became very active in the war in the protest of the war against Vietnam.
Yes, yes.
Were you one of those people who visited North Vietnam?
No, I had several invitations to come, but I was never allowed to go, either by my superiors, religious superiors, or by the government. When I came out of jail at the end of 72, the Vietnamese invited me to go, and we had to go into court and fought it in court for about 6 months and then wasn't allowed to go. So.
Now, you mentioned also your your religious superiors. You were a priest. Are you still a priest?
I'm not in good standing, but I'm a married priest. Mm.
I read somewhere that you were excommunicated. Is that correct?
Yes, at the time I was, and that's been lifted since. But I'm not able to operate officially.
Mm-hmm. And why did you leave, or why were you excommunicated? To get married, or were there other reasons to get married?
Yeah, as simple as that. Mandatory celibacy is the rule with us.
And you have children, don't you?
Yes, we have three.
And how old are they now?
Frida's 22, and she's a senior at Hampshire College in Massachusetts. Jerry's out here in the Midwest. He's a junior at Kalamazoo. And I hope he'll be coming up here this weekend because he's very active in the peace movement, and he's helped to form on campus quite a remarkable peace group there at Kalamazoo.
I think I read an article in the Washington Post magazine about you and Liz and your kids that I thought was a bit derisive, trying to make fun of you all. What was your reaction to that? Or what's your reaction to the media coverage of your participation? You were on 60 Minutes one time with your brother in the last 5 or 6 years, I think.
Yes. Yeah. Usually tailored for consumption by mass audience, and therefore not very factual, not very real, and not very close to the truth.
The sense I get is some of the mainstream media outlets like the Washington Post or 60 Minutes, Mike Wallace, want to turn you into a curiosity item. All those. You remember these guys from the 60s? Well, they're kind of still at it, and aren't they goofy? There's an attempt to make you goofy, don't you think?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. A curiosity, a novelty. Everything is a novelty here in this country, in this culture. And in order for you to be marketable able to be consumed by the public, you have to be portrayed this way, yeah.
But it's a real belittlement of politics.
Oh, of course it is. Of course it is. We came out here, and Jeremy and myself were reading the papers, the student papers up at the campus. And a young reporter had called us up, and I did an interview on the phone with him several nights ago. And he got it straight, and he put things down as he was told to put them down because he had done his homework and he was convinced that I was telling him the truth. And he put it down and he wrote a brilliant article. That's rather unusual with media people.
Right. Now, the one issue that you and Liz differ with many on the left is abortion. Can you state what your position is on abortion?
Well, I would take a conventional position on this, and I would say that we have no right to sacrifice the unborn. Yeah. And I would say further that we sacrifice the unborn to the tune of maybe a couple of million a year here in this country because we sacrifice the born.
And what do you mean by that?
I mean that everybody is living under a nuclear cloud and we're all up for grabs and we're on borrowed time and we're paying for our own destruction. And if we don't get it by nuclear war, and that might be inevitable as the nuclear club expands, we'll get it by poison.
Well, I disagree with you on abortion, but I do think that you and Coleman McCarthy and Liz and Nat Hentoff have a more consistent view than the people who are anti-abortion but pro-capital punishment, pro-nuclear arms,
sure,
and all that,
sure,
which seems just bizarre. Now, tell me about this nuclear war. The Cold War's ended. A lot of people seem to be lulled into thinking that the risk of nuclear war has passed. What do you make of that?
It's not passed at all. It's, the boys are off and running again. And we're in the midst right now of a somewhat muted arms race. Not with the Soviet Union, our old enemy, any longer, but with the rest of the world. And we're busily trying to fabricate enemies. We shift from the North Koreans, and then we're engaging the Iraqis and the Iranians again, and then we take a shot at Libya. And we wait for any of these people to raise their heads up, and we're ready to go against them. You know, and this means nuclear weapons. We had 600 warheads in the Persian Gulf during the Iraqi War, and if American troops had died there in any considerable numbers, we would have used those warheads. That's why they were there.
Are we going to be able to escape? I mean, or do you think there's going to be a nuclear holocaust sometime?
You know, people speculate that even nuclear devices have been used in some of the bombings around the planet, like in Bombay, like twice in London. They even suspected nuclear devices were used at the World Trade Center. You know, I don't know about that. I mean, there are arguments on both sides of the fence there, but I know we're vulnerable to small devices. And I know that as long as we keep this arsenal that we have, we're more vulnerable because of the arsenal.
Do you envision going back to prison to protest this arsenal or the war machine in general anytime soon?
Yeah. My health holds, and I don't see any other course. I could stay out, and I could take it easy, and I could declare myself retired, and I could do all of those things, but I'd be joining up if I did that. I'd be conscripted, and I would agree to the conscription.
Well, that's all the time we have, unfortunately. Philip Berrigan, thanks so much for being my guest on Second Opinion today.
Thank you, Matt.
I'll be back next week.
That was a Second Opinion interview with Philip Berrigan from 1996. The interview is from the KABU archives, and Second Opinion is no longer producing radio pieces. Philip Berrigan died Friday of cancer at the age of 79.